Hello, my name is Dr. Jim Doty, and I'm the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, where we explore the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. Hi, my guest today is Shauna Shapiro, PhD, a clinical psychologist and professor at Santa Clara University. She's also done an extraordinary TED Talk, which has been viewed by over 3 million people. And she's the author of multiple best-selling books, including Good Morning, I Love You, and the amazing children's book, Good Morning, I Love You, Violet. I hope you enjoy our conversation today. Thank you for listening. So, Sean, it's great to see you. I think the last time we connected, where was it? Were we in?
It was at Stanford.
Oh, our talk together. Yeah. I see the book was a great success. Of course, I'm talking about your wonderful book, Good Morning, I Love You. And it's still very popular, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's really been extraordinary, the reach. And I've been so delighted to see these practices really benefit so many people.
Well, in some ways, it's sad that so many people are suffering. Mm-hmm. What do you, and maybe in some ways this is repetitious or we've talked about this before, but what do you think it is so many people are having so many challenges in terms of anxiety, stress, depression, loneliness ultimately?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think two things. One is I think suffering is part of life. And so there's always the anxiety and the stress and the loneliness. And part of these teachings is learning how to deal with the inevitable sorrows that arise in this life. And also to be present for the inevitable joys. So I think my response would be one, I think suffering is always present. But two, I think particularly now, I think one of the things you said is loneliness. And I think we're scattered, we're fractured in terms of, you know, our families, our nuclear families, our extended families, in terms of our politics. And I think that that's creating a sense of isolation and loneliness that is really hard on people.
Well, it certainly seems like it. I was talking to someone and they were saying, if we had all the therapists available, we still wouldn't have enough time to deal with so many people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people and a lot of suffering. And there's been a lot of, you know, events that have happened that have been really hard. So I think one of kind of my intentions is to bring, you know, these very powerful science-based practices to as many people as possible and to really teach them in a universal way where, for me, they're kind of like skills. So that I call it mental fitness, right? Just like we can develop our physical fitness and a healthy body, we can develop our mind so that we have resources to face the inevitable challenges.
Well, it seems like, and it was interesting because I saw you on a, talking about, is it Virtusand? Is that what you're doing with Andy and David?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sort of addresses the whole package, I think. Sleep, exercise, nutrition, and mental resilience, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it's so fascinating, but I think the field is really shifting and that people are recognizing this kind of care for the whole person as essential and that we can't just focus on one thing like diet or mental health, that we have to focus on all of it, that we have to learn the importance of sleep. And the importance of, you know, our moving our physical body and the importance of training our mind. And so I'm working with Virtusyn and this wonderful team that you mentioned, Andrew Huberman and David Sinclair, to really offer people these resources because all of us have the capacity to train our mind and body in healthy ways. And I think so many people feel stuck in their lives or that they've missed their chance or they've made too many mistakes. And that's simply not true. I mean, we know from neuroplasticity and epigenetics that we're always changing and we actually have more control than we thought.
Well, I think that is a new revelation for a lot of people because I think a lot of people look outward for affirmation or something that will make them better. When I think, of course, the reality is that the power you have is really within you.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, and I don't want to negate, I think the external world is really important, right? Our social connections, our relationships, all these things impact us, of course. But really, what's under our purview is this interior landscape, and we can cultivate it. And we can cultivate it in very, very simple yet powerful ways.
No, I think that's exactly right, and it's one of the problems. I think it, maybe you can give me your thoughts. Is there's so much out there which is sort of woo-woo and pseudoscience,
Right.
and how do you judge or how do you know where to go or what to do?
Yes, I think that is the hardest thing right now is the information deluge that we're so overwhelmed, and it's hard to really discern what's real, what's science-based, and what I like that you said woo-woo. And I think, there's a couple of things. One is to really look for teachings that are based in science. I think for me, my kind of earliest experience with meditation and mindfulness and compassion was in Thailand and Nepal at monasteries, and maybe could have been called woo-woo, but definitely not in the mainstream culture. And what I experienced there was so profound that when I came back, I really dove into the science because I wanted to understand what happened and how it worked and how we could kind of rigorously teach it to others. And I think that's what's allowed for meditation to really come into the mainstream is that we have the science to back it up, and not just a little bit of science, but decades and thousands of research papers that demonstrate its efficacy.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing. And I would suggest that many of these practices have been experiential. And then they find something that works. And then they oftentimes a dogma is put around it. But at the end of the day, because of the experience of thousands and thousands, it sort of got fine-tuned, and now science has caught up to these practices and realize, I think, the profound nature of them and the recognition that, again, you have agency, and which a lot of people, I don't think, appreciate their own agency.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think the belief that something is possible is the most important place to start. In fact, as a clinical psychologist, one of the things they taught us early in graduate school was the best predictor of whether or not someone was going to change, whether or not they were going to quit smoking or start exercising, was whether or not they believed they could. And so I think that sense of agency is really important. And that for me is where the science comes in. That I use the science to motivate people because I say, don't take my word for it, look at the data.
Actually, that's sort of what the Dalai Lama says sometimes when he talks about Buddhism. He says, don't take my word for it. Educate yourself and then make an informed decision. But I think that's exactly right. And it's, again, how do we motivate people or get them there? Because I think there is a challenge between the commercial nature of how we live, or if you want to call the capitalist nature, which competes with sort of the good side. And I'm not trying to characterize capitalism as bad, but when it comes to ruthless capitalism, where everybody's trying to make a buck and they're self-focused, which I think has become, unfortunately, a underlying medicine or a message within our culture, because we continually preach about success, but unfortunately, for many, success in our society comes from the notion that once you reach a certain economic threshold or power position, that somehow that'll translate into happiness. And maybe you can give me your thoughts on that. I certainly have my own, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I agree. That has become kind of the story that the culture and that our society has fed us. But what the data show, right, we're talking about science, is that most people have what's called a happiness set point, and that this doesn't change very much regardless if they win the lottery or have a huge success, or actually if they're in a terrible accident and become paralyzed, that we tend to revert back to our baseline level of happiness. And that external factors don't really shift it. What's so fascinating about these meditative practices is we can see how shifting the mind, changing the interior, the internal factors, actually can shift our baseline level of happiness.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I'm familiar with these studies, as an example, with quadriplegics and a variety of others who have suffered greatly, and I think that's absolutely correct. They sort of return to their baseline. But I think what I'm more talking about are those people who chase after success and wealth, mm-hmm. and then they get there and they see it as a chimera, and they keep chasing it thinking that something's going to be different, because what they're chasing is this external affirmation that they think is going to make them better or get rid of their shame or their own insecurities.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why kind of I've shifted so much of my research and my work to compassion, and specifically to self-compassion. Because I think, just as you said, so many of us live with this constant shame, this sense of I'm not good enough, and this kind of drive to get external recognition to kind of fill the hole in ourselves. And what I've found in my own life, and also as a clinician, is that as we learn to love ourselves, as we learn to treat ourselves like we would treat a dear friend, that kind of urgency to receive love from the outside starts to quiet, and we're able to start to nourish ourselves.
Well, in some ways, that's the point of Good Morning, I Love You, right?
That is the point of Good Morning, I Love You. And in fact, that's why I titled it Good Morning, I Love You. It's now come out under a new title called Rewire Your Mind, which reaches a much broader audience. But the reason that I was so steadfast in my desire to call it Good Morning, I Love You is because that single practice changed my life in a way that nothing else has, that this ability to each morning greet myself with kindness, to say, good morning, I love you, Shauna, instead of waking up with like all the negative thoughts and the fears and the anxieties, to just have that moment of kindness and to see how it ripples out into the world.
No, I think that's really important. And as you were saying, I mean, some people treat themselves less kind than they treat anyone else. And it's sort of a fascinating sort of paradox, right? How you can possibly be critical. But, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with the baggage we end up carrying from our childhoods. And maybe you can comment about that.
Yeah, I think so many of us kind of we're ingrained with beliefs that we're not our own, that we're the sense of I need to achieve, to be loved, you know, constant kind of critical feedback. You know, when a child receives negative feedback, I just actually learned this, that the first 7 years of life, our children's brains are in what's called a theta state, which means they're highly suggestible. They're basically hypnotizable. And so anything that's going in at that time, they don't get to evaluate it or make sure it's true. It just locks in. And I think we kind of grow into these adults with a lot of insecurity, a lot of negative self-talk that we've internalized. And part of really my mission has been to help unwind that, to help people recognize their inherent self-worth and that they're worthy of love and kindness no matter what, right? That all of us are. And to begin to treat themselves the same way we would treat another human being, not even our best friend, but someone, you know, someone that we pass by. If they stumbled and fell, we wouldn't say, you idiot. We'd say, oh, can I help you? And yet when we stumble and fall, we're like, oh God, I'm so stupid, right? So I think it's about retraining these neural pathways of kindness, of compassion.
So let me ask you, from your own background, do you see where the challenges that you were facing, or how did that contribute? And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you know, everybody has a backstory, which, you know, they carry with them, and sometimes for good, sometimes for bad.
I think, you know, my story started pretty young. When I was 17, I had spinal fusion surgery. So I had a metal rod put in my spine. Pretty unexpectedly, I had scoliosis as a teenager, but it was pretty well cared for. And all of a sudden, I went through a growth spurt at 17. And I went to my doctor and he said, your spine is curved so much, it's going to puncture your lungs. We have to operate. And so really overnight, I went from this healthy, active teenager, I was captain of the volleyball team, to lying in a hospital bed, unable to walk. And I spent 6 months in the hospital bed. I never played volleyball again. And it was a really hard time in my life. And it wasn't just the physical pain. I mean, I remember just like learning how to even turn my head again was so painful, but it was really the mental anguish. Like, am I always going to be in pain? Or will I ever play volleyball again? Or, you know, will I get to go to college? And will anyone like me now that I have scars all over my body? And I remember it was during that time I became really depressed and really anxious, and there was a lot of suffering. And it was then that I learned about mindfulness, and it was almost like a pathway out, right? That I remember the first lines of the book that I read was from Jon Kabat-Zinn, and it said, whatever's happened to you, it's already happened. The only thing that matters is now what? And it, these words and this idea that I could shift my mind, even if I couldn't shift my external circumstances, really gave me hope and started me on this journey.
Yeah, in some ways, it reminds me of, I don't know if you've read Epictetus, but he was a slave. And basically, he said, I can't control my external circumstances, but I can control my internal dialogue, if you will. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point that so many people forget sometimes, that again, getting back to this idea of agency or self-agency. Now, we were talking about meditation, and of course I think both you and I agree that it has and continues to, you know, profoundly in a positive way affect people's lives. But that being said, we do hear reports about people who actually deteriorate doing certain types of mindfulness, or they find it too difficult. And maybe you can talk about that. In fact, I just saw an article, unfortunately, a young lady went to a 10-day Vipassana retreat and then actually significantly mentally deteriorated and ended up committing suicide. Now, I'm not saying that to scare people at all, but I think, you know, people also have to be aware that these types of practices for a subset of people are not helpful, or at least at the time they try utilizing them, and also that they're not meant to be a cure for necessarily everyone's problems.
Yeah, I think that's really important to emphasize that, one, this isn't a magic bullet, right? It's not a cure-all. And two, I think it's, you know, this is part of a larger kind of holistic approach to health, and it's not the only part. And I think that we need to be really discerning, first of all, in how these practices are taught, who they're taught to, and in what ways. And, you know, for me, that's really why I've focused on the research and really doing rigorous, you know, randomized controlled trials to find out what's best. You know, one thing we've learned is that mindfulness isn't the best first option for someone who's in major depressive disorder, that your mind is so out of control and so focused on the negative that you're just ruminating and rehashing, and it actually can be iatrogenic. And that what we found is that once you've been treated for depression and you've recovered, that mindfulness practices can prevent relapse by up to 78%. So we've been a little bit more nuanced in when is the best time to teach these and how. And I think that's really important, that I think so many people have found benefit in these practices that they get kind of excited and they say, oh, this is going to save you. And I don't know. And as a scientist and as a clinician, I want to make sure that I'm doing everything I can to understand how to teach it, when to teach it, and to whom.
No, I think that's a really critical component of these types of practices is who is the best candidate. And again, as you said, I think some people get confused or deluded thinking this is a panacea for every problem you may have. And I think it's interesting that you were pointing out that on some level, everyone is suffering. Mm-hmm. And while these practices can alleviate a lot of suffering, they're not for everyone. In fact, I think there's, do you know Ron Purser? He's written, yeah. What was the name of it? McMindfulness.
Right, the McMindfulness. I actually have that in one of my slides. That's why it sounded so familiar. And I think, you know, that gets back also to what you were talking about with the kind of over-commoditization of these practices, where people are using them to make money, or just they overly simplify them. And these practices are deceptively simple. They're the nuance and the capacity to kind of get off, you know, the pitfalls are numerous. And that's why for me, I really love the clinical work I do, where I work one-on-one with people. And it's very individually tailored. So you can be watching where their mind goes and where they can get off track. And the reason that I focus so much on self-compassion is because I think sometimes mindfulness is missing that. And it can be used as just one more way to beat yourself up, right? You're paying attention all day long and you're just like, I'm not doing this right, or I'm not good enough, or you're judging yourself. And I think the secret sauce really is to develop this kindness where you're actually on your own team as you pay attention.
It's interesting you say that, because I had a conversation, or actually a few, with Jon Kabat-Zinn, who of course is recognized for bringing mindfulness to the West. My statement was, and one of the reasons we developed the programs we did at Stanford, or have done at Stanford, is because I believe in traditional mindfulness, there is a feeling that on a, a covert level, it has inherent compassion or self-compassion with it, but it's not explicit. And yeah. I think that's really the key to much of this, because I think, you know, the body scan is great. The if you will, training your mind to be present. But unless you have these other two components, compassion, self-compassion, at least in my mind, I think that's where it can fail.
Mm-hmm. I 100% agree with you. In fact, I've devoted my career to this, because I believe that mindfulness is really composed of three elements. And the first is this attention or presence, which is what everyone talks about, but it's more nuanced. It's, why are you paying attention? What's your intention? What do you care about? What do you value? And also, how are you paying attention with this attitude of kindness and compassion? And that mindfulness actually is all three elements kind of synergistically co-arising. And if it's just about attention, this kind of cold, critical attention, it's not mindfulness. And I think that's where people get into trouble. And so really we've focused, you know, in fact, I'm coming out with a new textbook on this model of mindfulness. Jon Kabat-Zinn wrote the foreword for the textbook that really elucidates for people this intention, attention, attitude. And you have to cultivate all three elements to really begin to have the benefits.
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I guess we're a self-promoting two people here. We're both agreed. But that's good. You know, I was reading an article about a hedge fund manager, and he insisted that everybody study mindfulness. And as you pointed out, the agenda was not to be compassionate or self-compassionate. The agenda was, how do I become more focused and more ruthless and not let external events interfere with my focus? And right. To me, that's sort of the antithesis of what these practices were created for.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question, because as we're seeing a variety of ways in which we deal with, if you want to call it, the human condition or the nature of our suffering. Where do you see psychedelics fitting into this? Seems to, be at the tip of everyone's tongue. And of course, I think in Silicon Valley, everybody is microdosing, apparently. I had a wonderful conversation with Rick Doblin about some of the work of MAPS. But what are your own thoughts about that? And are you involved in any way with any of those organizations that are looking into this?
Yeah, I really believe that this is kind of the next horizon of mental health. And I think just like with meditation, I think we need to be very cautious and use rigorous science to determine how best to use these compounds to help people. As with anything, there's dangers and there's benefits. And again, it has to do with how we use it. So it really interesting. As I said, I've been working with Andrew Huberman on this project called VirtuSyn, and he's been doing a lot of podcasts on psychedelics. And the recent one that I came across was the one on ketamine. And I was so compelled by the rigor of the research and the scientific data. And at the same time, I was contacted by MindBloom, which is one of the top, ketamine-assisted therapies. And so in having conversations with them and really understanding kind of the rigor with which they clinically approach ketamine, we decided that I would create a program to help address burnout in people. And what excited me the most is, ketamine is really, what it does is it opens up this neuroplastic window. It gives you a bit of a different perspective on things and creates this opportunity. And so often people use ketamine, but then the most important parts are afterwards in the integration where you're carving out the new pathways, you're creating the learning. And so to integrate these science-based tools of mindfulness and compassion with this compound so that people can get the most learning from it. And so I created a program for burnout that will be paired with ketamine and to be used with professionals, to be used with other people. And I'm excited about it. I we'll look at the data and we'll see what the outcomes are. But the intention behind this, I think, is really to use these compounds in a way that can help assist learning. Because again, the way that I view all mental health right now, these practices is kind of as a mental fitness training. And that what we understand from neuroplasticity is that whatever we practice grows stronger. And so you can start to kind of cultivate these skills and these resources that can really be of benefit.
It's interesting. I'm fairly familiar with that literature, but I've been at actually a few, they're parties, not psychedelic parties, but there were individuals there who were self-treating with ketamine. Mm-hmm. And there were two instances where people, really were acting very bizarrely, and we actually had to bring health professionals, not that I'm not a physician, but that's not, they needed mental health assistance. But it sort of fascinates me that now it's being prescribed for a lot of depressed people mm-hmm. who I think many of them have had issues either with excessive use of narcotics or opioids or some of these other agents. And it seems as though there's a group of people who view this either recreationally or as another form of numbing themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's very scary and something to really pay attention to. I feel like it's like if you take a knife, right? A knife can be used to stab someone and kill them, or it can be used as a scalpel to save their life in surgery. And so I think as with all of these things, these compounds need to be used really carefully, to be regulated well, and to be really thoughtful in their applications. So I'm definitely not an advocate of using them at parties or recreationally in any way.
No. But it is interesting how, I think also, especially in the culture in Silicon Valley, there are all these people who are biohacking. Mm. And I think that On some level, it can be helpful to a subset of people, but sometimes people, like everything, take it to an extreme. In fact, I think analogous are some of these people who are now into longevity. And now I've spent some time with David Sinclair, actually, on Necker Island. We were together. But there's some people who are, they're taking 100 supplements a day. I think you're probably familiar with the fellow who's spending $2 million a year and regulating every aspect. And it's interesting because for some people, and probably myself, that seems somewhat self-indulgent and expensive. But he argues, well, I don't care what anybody thinks. I feel good about myself, and that's all that matters. And then you sit there and say, well, is that an egoist or a narcissist talking?
Yeah.
Or is that okay? And also, I think it puts a spotlight on the issue of who are these created for? Do you have to be a extraordinarily wealthy or affluent person to benefit from many of these things? I mean, where's the democratization of this?
Right. And the ethics of it. I think these are really important questions. And I think for me, one of the things that supports me in thinking them through is, from a mindfulness lens, everything's interconnected. That part of what allows you to live a long and healthy and beautiful life is your sense of connection, is your sense of belonging, is your sense of generosity, right? We know that people who volunteer and people who are generous live longer and are healthier. So I think even if you take, $2 million a year, but you have a very selfish, isolated approach, I think that you're not going to live as good and healthy and long a life. So I think that there's going to be checks and balances to this. I am gravely concerned that our healthcare system is really starting to get even more divided, and that to get good healthcare, you have to spend a lot of money. And I think one of my intentions in working with a company like MindBloom, or also with VirtuSyn, VirtuSyn is offering these technologies for free. And there is so much that people can do that can benefit them, even just learning how to sleep, in a healthy way, how to practice good sleep hygiene, and to learn different body scans or meditative practices that help you sleep, or to hydrate, or to not drink diet sodas, to teach people ways to change their behavior so that, like we've talked about, they have more agency than we realize.
It's interesting. I was having a conversation the other day with BJ Fogg, who I'm sure you know about this, his book Tiny Habits, but now there are a few others. But this idea of being able to change your behavior, because I think what happens with a lot of people, and I have to say I'm probably guilty of it, is, yes, I'm going to do this, but I do it always extreme. Now I'm and you're able to do it for a little period of time, and they go, oh, damn it, I'm going to have some ice cream. And I think that understanding the power of, small changes, I think, is really important.
Absolutely. Shinzen Young was one of my early teachers, and he always would say, subtle is significant, that these minor micro habits are significant. And in my book, I have a whole chapter called the 5% principle. And it's about, how do you make micro changes? How do you practice 5% more? It's not, we have to really, I think, eliminate this myth of perfection and this idea that, it only counts if we do it exactly right. That, think about compound interest. If someone said they were going to give me 5% on $1 million for the next 20 years, I would certainly say yes, right? So we can make 5% shifts in our behavior that lead to significant outcomes.
No, I think that is really a critical aspect, and not to feel that unless you go extreme, you're a loser or you're not really disciplined. And mm-hmm. So I think that's very important. And again, the other thing you emphasized, and I I'm sure you're familiar with, what is it, the Harvard Adult Development Study by Robert Waldinger. This is where I think also people sometimes get confused because, you know, we talk about the benefits Bob Buettner talks about with longevity and the blue zones. Clearly the most important aspect, far beyond, let's say, the 10,000th Mediterranean diet cookbook to guide you along on your journey, is depth of relationships and human connections. And I think, you know, that's something we always need to emphasize for people, because again, they read these articles that talk about aspects of this, whether right. it's, you know, moderate exercise or moderate alcohol use or not smoking or eating this plant-based diet. But, and I think you alluded to this. But what I'm saying, though, it's not to negate all of any of those things, but to recognize that, you know, doing those while you're completely disconnected from everyone is actually extraordinarily unhealthy.
Absolutely. And that's why I think our relationship to ourselves is crucial, that we, you know, in fact, one of my favorite, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, but in Tibetan, the word for compassion always includes oneself. And if you don't include yourself, it's considered incomplete or not really even compassion. That if we're doing all the right things with the wrong attitude, it's not going to have the same impact. And that's why for me, this teaching of this mindfulness with compassion kind of blended together is really at the foundation of everything. And then when I choose to eat healthy, right, it's, I'm realizing I'm taking care of myself, and it's also rippling out into the world, that I realize everything I do has echoes in this universe, and that I'm never alone, that I'm completely interconnected. And that's always part of my choice, right? The way that I make choices and how to live.
It's interesting when you said you're not alone and we're all connected. I'm sure you probably read Scott Barry Kaufman's book on Transcend, he's Good. Brought a book out, I think about a year ago, called Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization. But the interesting thing about it was he became a fan of Abraham Maslow. Mm-hmm. And actually, all of us, I think, or at least I did, thought of his, pyramid, which he actually never created a pyramid. That was created afterwards. But, sort of the base requirements and ultimately self-actualization. But his argument is, and which what Abraham Maslow added to this was transcendence, or this idea of oneness or depth of connection. And that's the highest level, if you will, of our self-mastery, or as far as we can go in terms of how we see the world.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Speaking of that, though, one of the challenges, though, for so many people is the ever-increasing sense of separateness or divisiveness. And do you offer any insights, or do you have any thoughts about that? Listen, I'm not. It's like trying to ask you, can you solve the next world war? It is always interesting to see what people think about many of these things.
Well, here's what's interesting. So, you know, we have what's called a confirmation bias. We have what's called an anchoring bias. So people tend to only attend to the data that confirms what they believe. And whatever we initially kind of anchored into our mind, we tend to look for things that confirm that. So it's very hard to get someone to change their mind. The other thing that happens is when someone agrees with you, you release dopamine, which feels good, right? So you're motivated to be around people that agree with you. All this leads to a lot of divisiveness, a lot of separation, a lot of biases that we're unaware of. One of the parts of mindfulness that I'm so excited about is that short practices can interrupt these biases. That they did a study at UC Berkeley that showed that just 10 minutes of mindfulness practice actually interrupted what's called own race bias, which means you tend to recognize people of your own race more than other people. And I find that fascinating. So I think this is a new field that could really be helpful, is this ability to kind of suspend these biases and to truly listen to each other. To listen to each other, Paul Tillich calls it a listening love, to actually see our deeper connections. And that's really my prayer and my hope for all of us is that we're able to step outside of this small sense of self and really recognize these different perspectives and views with a lot of compassion.
Well, I think Thich Nhat Hanh was another advocate of compassionate listening. And I think that is the challenge for many of us. But I think also this idea, and I think it relates to what you were just saying of emotion regulation and not be reactive. Because, you know, when these thoughts come up, then everything kicks in. But if you're able to sort of stop it before it takes off, then I think you can actually interrupt it.
Absolutely. And I think that for me is the hallmark of mindfulness, is that it deactivates the centers of the brain that are, have trouble with impulse, and it brings on board the rational, compassionate part of the brain, so that you're able to pause in between that, trigger or stimulus and your response, and actually choose your response.
No, and I agree with you, and I think that's really the a very, very powerful message, which is our own ability again to choose our response. Because once something takes off, it's a heck of a lot harder to stop it. You'd mentioned Berkeley, and obviously our friend Dacher Keltner has written a book about awe, and I think maybe you can just tell me how you incorporate this idea of awe or joy you mentioned or clarity into your own life, which I think a lot of people would be interested in. What practice do you do? I mean, in terms of meditation, as an example, I think anyone who has been in the meditation world for a while ultimately, though, creates a practice that works for them. And maybe you could share with us sort of how you, maybe begin your morning and how you sort of regulate yourself throughout the day. Because, as you said, all of us are presented with things that are challenges. And maybe you can give the listeners a little bit of idea on how you deal with them.
Yeah, I'm so happy you brought this up because I do think people mistakenly believe that mindfulness is just about stress reduction, but it also increases life's inherent joys because when we're more present with them, we're able to really savor them. We're able to actually kind of make them part of our, overall chemical soup, right? So, I'm really glad you brought this up. And a couple practices I do. So one is, as I mentioned before, I start every morning by placing my hand on my heart and just saying, "Good morning, I love you." And first of all, placing your hand on your heart releases oxytocin. It's good for you, right? This kind of love hormone or safety. But two, it kind of begins the trajectory of my day in a positive way, reminding myself to be kind, right, to myself and to have that extend out. The other thing that I'm really loving is there's a term called glimmers in polyvagal theory. And this idea of just looking at these micro moments of goodness throughout the day, to really pay attention to them, to absorb kind of this sense that in this moment I'm okay. In this moment, my nervous system is regulated, I'm safe. And I think we put so much more of our attention on when we're in danger or when we're afraid. And to really orient my days towards the good, has been incredibly helpful. The last thing I will say is I think gratitude is a superpower. It's one of the fastest way to change your neurochemistry. And so I every evening before bed practice gratitude. And in fact, in my journal that I created, Good Morning, I Love You, the journal, every evening there's a place for gratitude because gratitude has been shown not just to impact our health, but also to help us sleep better. So it's a wonderful way to end your day.
No, thank you for sharing that. And I think that's really important. I think sort of combined with gratitude is also this idea of forgiveness. which I think is also important. I think what a lot of people don't realize oftentimes is that they end up carrying baggage that's associated with somebody who they felt wronged them or something happened which they attribute to that other person. And what they don't appreciate, though, is that negative feeling they associate with it then repeatedly comes back unless you're able to let that go. So, well, Shauna, it's been great having you with me. Thank you for sharing your insight and wisdom. And maybe you can tell us so the old book, Good Morning, I Love You, is now going to be called What? And then tell us the latest project. I know you mentioned VirtuSand, but any other exciting projects you're doing or things we should look out
Yes.
for?
Well, I'm very excited to share. I have a new children's book that is out. It's called Good Morning, I Love You, Violet. And it's about a young girl's journey into self-compassion and really learning how to not be so critical and negative of herself. And I'm not a children's book writer. And in fact, that's not my area of expertise. But as I've really learned more about neuroplasticity, the window of opportunity we have with our children is so extraordinary that I felt compelled to share these teachings. So that's been wonderful and very exciting, this new children's book. And yes, and then I have my new textbook coming out, which I'm also very excited about because it's all of the extraordinary, shifts we've seen in the field of mindfulness, all of the science. And it's really heartening to see, how many universities and graduate programs are incorporating mindfulness and how it's really becoming a foundation, kind of the fabric of our mental health care.
What is the name of the new textbook?
The Art and Science of Mindfulness.
Ah, wonderful. Well, fantastic. Well, listen, thanks again for sharing your morning with me. And I suggest to all of our readers they pick up certainly Good Morning, I Love You. And tell me again what the t new title is.
Rewire Your Mind.
Oh, Rewire Your Mind by Shauna Shapiro. So take care. And again, thanks everyone for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, thank you for being with us today. The Into the Magic Shop podcast can be found where you find your most popular podcasts, or you can find us at intothemagicshop.com.